Before we start, I want to give a quick shout out to Squarespace for their support. For more information on how to build your own website, go to squarespace.com/guardian. Welcome to What Would a Feminist Do? I'm Jessica Valenti, Guardian columnist. Today we'll be talking about relationships. What does a feminist relationship look like when you're talking about domestic work? In 2016, what does it mean to make our relationships equal? We asked random people walking around Manhattan how they divide up responsibilities in their relationships and what they struggle with.
I'm responsible for directions. He has a really terrible sense of direction.
I'm still at home taking care of her, but her father is definitely spending the time he has with her and bringing her to bed, and so I do get some free time too.
So it's like, you don't do this like, hey, this is your chore for the week. You kind of pick up where they left off. If I missed it this time, you do it next time. If I got dinner tonight, you'll probably get dinner tomorrow. You don't even discuss it. It just happens.
And it got to the point where I just got tired of it because I felt like I was doing so much for him and I wasn't getting like the effort back, and I felt unappreciated. And I feel like that's the reason why the relationship didn't work.
Equally, actually.
Yeah.
If I have time, I do the cooking. I do the laundry.
Yes.
If she has time, she does the cooking and laundry.
I tend to be more on in the nighttime. He tends to be more on in the morning. So we have sort of a day division of labor where he handles things when we wake up. I sort of handle things in the evening.
To answer some of these questions, we'll be hearing from clinical psychologist Bravada Garrett Akinsanya.
If there are bills to pay, pay together. Even though you know you've never balanced your checkbook accurately in your life, if your partner knows how to do it together.
But first, a rant about motivation. So I wanted to talk about motivation because I'm super frustrated with the way that we talk about motivating men to do housework in particular. I feel like there has been this spate of articles recently about how to get your man to do the dishes, like how to get him to, you know, pick up his socks or help with childcare or whatever, which is, first of all, just insulting to men because it assumes that they sort of need this carrot on a stick, you know, to get them to do anything. But it also is just like offensive in this whole other way. There were a couple of studies recently, one that showed men who do more housework have more sex with their partners, and another one that said men who do more housework have more ambitious daughters, and the studies were sort of presented as this way of here are two really good reasons to do housework. And it pissed me off because that's fine and that's great that you're having more sex and that your daughter is really ambitious, but like, how about you just do the housework because it's there and because it needs to be done and because that's the right thing to do? And this idea that men need a reason other than that, like, strikes me as really profoundly gross and weird. And I know that Lean In had a big project that was related to men and housework. And, you know, Lean In does amazing work, and this is not like a total bash on them, but they had a whole article that called it chore play, right? Like, for men to think of it as chore play, which is such a gross word anyway, but again, like, gets to this idea that, like, men should be doing chores as a way to have sex with their wives, which is not okay. And it also just strikes me as really transactional and strange. But of course, like, we still do have this problem that women are doing three times as much housework as men in the U.S. And the other piece of it that we don't really talk about as much, but I think is really important, is the mental labor that you sort of can't account for, right? It's not like doing the dishes or making dinner where you know who is doing what. You know, there's cooking dinner, and then there's remembering, like, what needs to be on the grocery list or who, you know, when you're going to run out of toilet paper. Like, that stuff takes up a lot of space in your brain. And I think that headspace and the ability to think is a privilege in a way. That's not to say that things aren't getting better. They are. You know, studies have shown that men are doing more work than they have in years past, and they're, you know, willing to do it, not being sort of forced into it by weird motivations. But I think that we need to get past this idea that we need to convince men to do their fair share of labor in the home. They should just do it. They should just do it because the dishes are dirty and the dishes need to be done, or because dinner needs to be cooked and your kid is waiting to be picked up from school. I think that that's plenty reason enough. So my guest today is Dr. Bravada Garrett Akinsanya, a clinical psychologist with over 30 years of experience. She has written about stress management, Black feminist leaders, cultural competence, and she heads up her local chapter of the Society for the Psychology of Women. Bravada, welcome.
Thank you so very much. I'm excited to be able to speak on an area in which I hold a great deal of love and respect.
Excellent. So, you know, we're talking a little bit about domestic work, and I think for a lot of people, sort of the everyday domestic stuff that couples do might seem a little mundane or boring, but, you know, these things are never really about who's picking up the kids from school or who does the grocery shopping or who takes care of the finances, right? Like, what are those issues really about, you think, in a relationship?
It's often about power. Mm-hmm. And power is often affiliated with the allocation of resources. And even when I talk about resources, I'm not just talking about money. I'm talking about time. I'm talking about expertise. I'm talking about emotional availability. Those are resources that are relevant in a relationship. And it's not just task-oriented. It's also being able to use one's skills and abilities to promote the betterment of the family.
Right. So you've been practicing for a long time. Can you, I mean, without breaking any confidentiality, is there like a couple or a person or a case that really stood out to you? You know, maybe some folks who are struggling with ways to make their relationship more equal and egalitarian that you could talk about without revealing too much?
Yeah, it usually comes up in careers. When we have two educated people, or even just two people who don't have high levels of education, two working parents. So in these cases, when one partner, let's say if it's a woman and she's going to have a baby, that mm-hmm. often introduces one of the hardest decisions that a family makes. And if the woman who's having the baby has to take off work, it impacts mm-hmm. the family. One of my clients, for example, she was in a relationship. She still is in the relationship. Mm-hmm. And in their relationship, because they both are pretty low income, when she had the baby, she had to take off work because the employment that she had wasn't producing mm-hmm. enough income to even cover child care. So right. she had to stay home to work with the babies because, you know, mm-hmm. actually her contribution would have been less had she gone back to work. So in couples, right. I see career issues being challenging. I see exhaustion being a big challenge because even regardless of who is there, being relegated to take a particular role when you would like to be a dad who stays home and gets to see the baby's first step, having to make those choices often depends on the fact that there are limited social-cultural supports in place in our society to help people have egalitarian processes in their relationship.
Absolutely. I remember there was, I think it was in Sweden where they had paid, you know, paternity leave and men just weren't taking it. You know, even though it was available, they weren't taking it because of this sort of social expectation that that's not what men do, which I thought was just fascinating. But you hit on something really interesting that I was hoping you could talk a little bit more about. You know, financial resources and class and the way that work and exhaustion can sort of play into these issues. I think when we hear about relationships and equal relationships and domestic work, we're often hearing about really high earning couples mm-hmm. and not folks of different incomes. Can you just talk a little bit about that and how that might impact a relationship?
Yes, I would love to talk about that. In fact, the cultural, socioeconomic status, and gender variables really play a large role in whether a couple is going to exhibit egalitarian processes. And mm-hmm. actually, the research showed, there are some couple of studies that looked at African-American couples, and mm-hmm. they showed that they tended to demonstrate more egalitarian couples than their white counterparts. And that's because of the role sharing. In many couples, low-income couples that are ethnically diverse, which also often in our society corresponds with low income or lower mm-hmm. income, they tend to share roles more easily. People have to share roles because there's not enough income for a mom to stay home. There's not enough income for a dad to stay home. So everybody has to know how to cook. Everybody knows has to know how to fold clothes and wash dishes.
Right.
The most unhealthy part has been the impact of cultural factors that push people who are collectivists into more individualistic processes in their relationship. Those have created some challenges for diverse families, but they tend to be more egalitarian because they have to by virtue of survival.
That's really interesting. I've also seen that some studies have shown that queer couples or same-sex couples tend to take on more equal shares of domestic responsibility or have more egalitarian relationships, much more so than straight couples. Do you see that as related, or do you think that can be, sort of attributed to the way that traditional gender roles function differently in different relationships?
No, actually, even the literature that we look at talks about the fact that there's more role flexibility among gay couples, and they are more apt to be adaptive in using whatever role is possible and necessary. And the negotiation between those roles definitely creates often healthier and stronger relationships, but they have to push against the societal expectations.
Right.
Most healthy couples rely on each other to be supportive and to be collaborators and to be interdependent on the skill set of the person with whom they've partnered. Usually that's the real strength of a relationship, is that together they make something stronger than they would alone.
Right. With the idea that, sort of dividing stuff by who is strong at whatever, can that be tricky to navigate? Like, I wonder, because I hear so often from folks in relationships when they're having conflict that they're like, oh, well, women just clean up better than men. You know what I mean? Like, this idea that, like, women or men are just naturally better at something. Like, how do you sort of work around that?
One of the things that I believe happens is that we groom people to have a skill set that puts them in that recalcitrant position of not being able to exchange their roles. But in healthy families, people actually teach their children to be survivors in all areas. Healthy parenting requires parents to keep a feeling of plasticity in their development of their children by exposing them to multiple roles, not just employment roles, but household roles, ways of showing intimacy, expectations, multiple roles. And when they do that and they fill their children with that level of diversity, the kids themselves become more flexible in life.
Right.
They tend to do better in terms of success. They adapt better, and they're able to handle stressors a lot better than kids who are more rigid in what they think they can and cannot do.
I mean, it's something that I have a 5-year-old daughter, and it's something I think a lot about and struggle with. And I had not a similar experience, but I think anyone who's been around kids has that experience of seeing the way that gender role expectations impact them. When I was a teenager, I used to babysit for my male cousins, and I'll never forget walking in to one of their rooms, and he was only three years old, maybe not even three, and he was holding a little baby doll, and he was cradling a baby doll, and the minute that I walked in the room, he threw the doll across the room. And I could see that he was, like, ashamed to have been caught babying this doll. And it was so distressing to me because he was so young.
Exactly.
And I couldn't figure out, where did he pick up this idea that caretaking was somehow shameful for a boy?
Exactly.
It's incredible to me just how early it starts.
Exactly.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in a moment.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace. Whether the story behind your passion is out of the ordinary or simply out of this world, you should tell it in an unforgettable way. Squarespace helps you do just that with the only websites designed to showcase what makes your passion worth pursuing. Start your free trial today at squarespace.com/guardian.
I think, you know, for a lot of us who are interested in feminism and, as you said, like, are interested in sort of breaking those patterns, in theory, that all sounds great. I want to do that. But I've also noticed, like, in practice, it can be so difficult. Yeah. Like, for those of us who grew up in households where the gender roles were really traditional or very starkly different, it can sort of be hard to change on an everyday basis this sort of understanding of what relationships are supposed to look like. I found in my own relationship, I'm married, even though I'm a feminist and I do this for a living and I think about these issues all the time and I try to be proactive about these issues, it was so easy for me to slip into traditional gender roles. It was so easy for me to sort of just take on more of the domestic work and more of the child care and have that be like the default position. So are there like practical ways we can sort of shift our thinking on this?
Yeah, it's one of the things that I do with when I work with couples is I actually have a model that I use. It's sociocultural factors of shared power and control. And one of the first things I teach them is to, instead of doing things in isolation, to make community inclusion a part of their process. So that way, the partner, either one, the husband, the wife, whoever the partners are, they look not just to themselves to handle tasks, but they create a community so that quickly you learn that I don't have to be the one to always cook dinner. They can go to grandma's. Another thing I do is I teach them to show emotional affirmation and to be able to articulate that, you know, honey, I'm tired of doing the dishes every week. Why don't we take months? Or why don't you do it on Mondays and Fridays? And because I have class on Wednesdays, you know, we can eat out. So to teach them to negotiate what would be a healthy way to manage things. And it really takes work because it takes a lot of honesty and accountability is another thing that I put in that model where I teach clients to be assertive and saying, honey, you said you were going to cook on Fridays, but for the past three Fridays, you haven't done anything at all about dinner and we can't eat pizza every week. So being able to have those dialogues. And so I think it takes getting out of the box and using a set of skills that challenge you to be your best. And I know it can be comfortable to slip into those modes of traditional expectations. But what happens is when you get tired of it, and you've done it for a long time, the other partner won't be used to trading off. And then it's like, we've been married, we've been together 15 years, now you suddenly want me to start washing dishes, you know? So I just say you started off on the good foot from the beginning, and there's always ways to back up and redo it, but it takes negotiation. And as a couple becomes engaged with each other over a course of time, they constantly do a dance of discussion, renegotiation, and redefining how they are together. And when you bring kids into the mix, that constant, the skill set of being able to do that is imperative. That leads to more egalitarian support because you learn that you have limits as a human being. And dysfunctional families are the ones where people are rigidly set in roles that they can't get out of. And so I always try to encourage people to share roles. You know, if there's laundry to do, do it together. If there are bills to pay, pay together. Even though you know you've never balanced your checkbook accurately in your life, if your partner knows how to do it together. So you become teachers and students, lifelong teachers and students for each other.
That's fantastic advice. I love that. I love it. And on the advice tip, speaking of advice, so we do a little bit of an advice segment on the show, and I was hoping that you could help us out with it.
Oh, that's so exciting.
Good. So a listener of the podcast wrote in to my Facebook page anonymously. They didn't want me to use their name, but they asked this question, and I thought it was really interesting, especially given the stuff that you said about, you know, community and the importance of community outside of the couple as well. And they ask, I have a friend who just had a baby, and she seems to take on all of the work while her partner does little to nothing. Do I say something to her about it? How do I help? What do you think about that?
I think she should say something, and mm-hmm. I think she should offer to support her. It's not an unusual thing that happens. I think one of the first things that we do as psychologists is we use a technique called mm-hmm. cognitive reframing. Mm-hmm. You redefine the reality in front of you. Mm. And often when I've worked with couples, especially with early first children, I find that men aren't invited into the parenting realm.
Right.
They're not invited to hold the baby or to change the baby or to nurture the baby. And they're often very afraid. They're afraid to break something or do something wrong.
Right.
And so I often tell couples, and if they have a friend like that, that she can babysit for them both.
Sure.
She can encourage her friends. She could tell her friend, it's his baby too. Don't you think he wants to hold the baby?
Right.
Don't you think he wants to change diapers? That's the joy of parenting. And
right.
to redefine why he's not involved and let him, and she can, the wife can coach him on how to hold the baby and feed the baby and, you know,
yeah.
help with the baby. And not only that, she can, you know, reward him for breaking outside of that stereotype by telling him, I appreciate you. I
yeah.
know that, you know, you might not have felt comfortable doing it, but you're a great dad and you're going to be a great dad and you're a great partner. And it
right.
starts at home.
Right. That's excellent. So I have one last question for you before you go. And that's sort of about sex and just like physical intimacy. And I'm wondering if you can talk about the way that inequality or equality in a relationship sort of impacts intimacy between a couple, or if it does impact intimacy.
It does. Often we think of intimacy as sexual, but there are actually 10 types of intimacy. And one of them is around emotional intimacy, where you
right.
share your thoughts and your feelings. Another one is intellectual intimacy, where you talk about issues like politics or
mm-hmm.
beliefs. There's spiritual intimacy, where you share a common belief, not religion necessarily, but spiritual thoughts. There's recreational intimacy, where you have things that you do together. So if your partner plays tennis and you play tennis, then that's cool. But if your partner plays basketball and you're only 5'1", like me, it's I could play, but not very well. You probably want to let your partner go do something with somebody else. But I can certainly play ping pong and beat him every time. So that's recreational intimacy. Then there's social intimacy, where you do things like go to movies and things
right.
together. And economic intimacy, where you talk about your bills and your finances. Parenting intimacy, where you
yeah.
talk about how you parent together. And household intimacy around chores.
Mm-hmm.
There's vocational intimacy, where you talk about your work experience and your work life. And what we call genital or sexual intimacy
mm-hmm.
often hinges on the fact that if I feel left out in all those other areas,
right.
and you want to come in at night and say hi to me, then it's probably unlikely that you're
right.
going to, you know, be successful.
Right.
So, and if I'm so tired of doing all those other things by myself, and you're coming in at night and want to, you know,
yeah.
get down, then it's not it's not likely that I'm going to be available to you. So trying to make sure that couples are balanced in sharing intimacy in all those areas creates an atmosphere of egalitarian support in what the African call Ubuntu.
Mm-hmm.
Ubuntu is a sense of humanity,
mm.
a sense of value. And another word we use is Marua, which is a Swahili for respect. And the Swahili have like 26 words for respect.
Wow.
But Marua is the highest form. It means you're connected to me. I value you. I love you. I respect you. And because I hold you in such high esteem, I will do what I can to maximize your joy and minimize your pain.
Right.
That is what relationships are about. That's what it means to show true intimacy mm-hmm. and true egalitarian support.
I love that. That sounds wonderful.
Yeah, and we can do it. It just takes work.
It does take work. Pravada, thank you so much for coming on and sharing so much of your knowledge with us. That was fantastic.
Thank you. It was just really, really super exciting and fun.
Dr. Pravada Garrett Akinsanya is a writer and feminist psychologist based in Minneapolis. That's it for this week. I'm Jessica Valenti for The Guardian. I hope you'll join me in 2 weeks for What Would a Feminist Do?